And just how powerful is the brain, the mind? We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Marilyn Schlitz, Dr. Charles Grobe on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Schlitz, let's talk a little bit more about this conference. Fascinates me with these experts that are going to get together. Will there be experiments there or anything like that?
Oh, we're going to have all kinds of fun things. I think about this conference, Consciousness in Action, as sort of three things. One is a real deep examination of your question about, you know, can we really see this in the future, like the idea that something like hallucinogens might be prescribed? You know, it's like, what is this new story that we're moving into? And so it'll be a deep examination of a variety of different issues in terms of business, in terms of politics, in terms of science. It's also, I think, a celebration of the fact that in addition to all that's wrong in the world, there are a lot of really interesting, innovative, breakthrough ideas that are happening in a variety of different domains, including the kind of thing that Charlie Grobe is talking about, the kind of things Dean Radin will be talking about,
sure,
in terms of entangled minds, Lynn McTaggart, The Power of Intention, Bob Thurman, the famous Buddhist scholar and comparative religion expert, and we'll have, you know, Rhianne Eisler and Van Jones talking about, you know, civic action. So it's called Consciousness in Action, and there'll be different, what I like to think about as integral approaches. In other words, that there's no one perspective that's going to really take us to the next level, but that we need multiple perspectives. So, for example, when you think about a transformation in medicine, I can envision that we may well move toward a system of medicine that is more about the promotion of healing and less about the focus on disease,
mm-hmm,
and prevention, and embracing a multiplicity of different tools and technologies, that including hallucinogens, but not, you know, not in a fixated, single-pointed way, but as part of a whole different array of options, from mind-body to body, and recognizing the intelligence of the body, the wisdom of it to correct itself, and, you know, and then our relationship to the environment, our relationship to this kind of non-local dimension of interconnectedness. All of that, I think, promotes sort of a different model of reality, and so this conference will be about celebrating that. And we really would love as many people to come out and celebrate together as possible. And as I said, it's in Palm Springs in August 9th through the 12th. And people could learn more about it at noetic.org, www.noetic.org. And I think it's just going to be a really great opportunity, in addition, for people to take new tools away with them. How is it that if we are, you know, living in a time of complexity, there is, you know, a variety, or are a variety of different ways in which you can interpret what's going to happen next? Is it going to be doom and destruction, or are there ways that we can see our way through this? And, you know, to kind of align toward the possibilities of a better future, what are the tools we're going to need to do that? And so that's one of the things. We have a teacher coming. He's a Muslim teacher, Yasser Chadli, who will talk about Sufism, and we have a yoga Hindu teacher that's going to talk, and, you know, we'll have the spiritual traditions as well as the scientific traditions as well as business and social action all coming together in one place to have a wonderful conversation about consciousness in action.
Are you saying that it looks like, for one of the first times, that modern science and medicine might be getting together with what we've always called metaphysical areas, and maybe they're going to finally put the two together?
I think it's been happening. You know, if you look at the area of, like, mind-body medicine, for example, and you think about even 20 years ago, certainly 30 years ago, you know, it was the exclusive domain of a group of granola-eating hippies in the mountains of Northern California. You know, nobody had ever heard about it, and if they did, they snickered. It's now, yoga studios are all over America. It's on the front page of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. You know, it's gone mainstream in a way that definitely says the culture is changing. And I think that's how it's going to change. If we want to change medicine, if we want to change, you know, society in terms of the environment, or, you know, whatever the domain is, it's recognizing that our consciousness really you know, propels us, it inspires us, it leads us, it helps us. And the more we can learn about consciousness and the more we can learn about our potentials, you know, the more aware we can be about the kind of changes we're calling for.
Now, Charles, do you think mainstream medicine will embrace this or fight it?
Well, I think, as Marilyn says, we've already seen a progression from a point where mainstream medicine was highly resistant to even acknowledging the existence of these alternative models, to a point in time now where I think there is greater receptivity. Keep in mind also that many of the most those who were most adversive to opening up to these new ideas years ago have already exited from the stage. We have a whole new generation, and I think the newer generation of professionals are coming in with a greater level of receptivity. So I think we are seeing an evolution in this direction of acknowledging and even embracing the value of these consciousness studies to help us advance the field and advance the culture.
Tell us a little bit about your own research with some of these hallucinogens, the ayahuasca, the psilocybin, and MDMA, for example.
Sure. Well, I've done three studies. As we talked about earlier, my current study is working with psilocybin to treat the anxiety and depression associated with advanced stage cancer. I've also done considerable work in Brazil, particularly in the Brazilian Amazon, in the city of Manaus, back in the early 90s with my colleagues Dennis McKenna and Jace Calloway, where we examined the use of ayahuasca within the context of a Brazilian syncretic religion, a religion which had permission from the Brazilian government to use ayahuasca as a psychoactive sacrament in their religious ceremonies. We did a very comprehensive psychological and medical and neurobiologic examination of the range of effects of ayahuasca. And we were also very impressed with the individuals with whom we interacted, who were part of this syncretic religion, the União de Vegetal, or the UDV, it was just a very impressive structure and individuals who had some very moving stories of personal and collective transformation. A number of the individuals that I interviewed formally as part of the study and also who I spoke with informally outside of the study were individuals who, prior to their introduction to this a religion that uses ayahuasca as a sacrament, had been plagued by disabling addictive disorders. And following their introduction to ayahuasca within this carefully, highly structured religious context, had really transformed their lives. And of course, you know, all religions can point to their success stories, can point to individuals who cease being addicts or alcoholics. But what really impressed us here was that with a compound like ayahuasca, very potent hallucinogen, individuals are in a very hyper suggestible state, and here they're being provided information and messages designed to really open their views, open their consciousness, and to heal and to evolve. And we feel that this utilizing this compound in such an optimal setting really increases the likelihood of positive, even therapeutic outcomes.
Could you OD on ayahuasca? In that, I'm told the stuff tastes horrible. You know,
that's true. It's a very vile tasting compound. It's not uncommon for individuals to have nausea or even to vomit. But in regards to overdosing, that would virtually be impossible, given the level of the amount of the brew one would have to consume would probably be beyond anyone's volitional ability.
Maybe because also it tastes so bad,
terrible, yeah, really. Yeah. Which is honestly, that's a disincentive for such a compound being used in any kind of inappropriate or recreational context. It's, it tastes terrible, and also outside of the carefully structured ceremonial context, the compound has, I think, some additive inherent risk.
What's the risk, and then how quickly does it work?
Well, I mean, risks taking it, you know, outside of expert supervision and guidance, the risk could be a terribly frightening and cognitively disorganizing experience, which hopefully would resolve not too long after the experience, but perhaps in some cases might lead to a sustained disturbed level of consciousness. In terms of the relative action of ayahuasca, it's active within about 45 minutes to an hour after consuming it, and the duration is about 3 to 4 hours.
3 to 4 hours.
Right. Let me also mention there are some one of the most serious risks that we have become aware of and that we have published in the medical literature about is the risk of adverse drug interactions. For instance, you know, in our society over the last couple of decades, millions of people have been administered SSRI antidepressant medications such as Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil. Taking ayahuasca, if one is already taking an SSRI antidepressant, can induce a serious medical condition called the serotonin syndrome, which can lead to a severe confusional state, high temperature, tremulousness. It's a wretched experience.
Though you have to have a pretty good amount of serotonin in your brain, don't you?
Well, yes, of course. But you. What would happen here would be because of the extra serotonin available through the SSRI antidepressant, the specific chemical action of the ayahuasca can lead to excessive amounts, well beyond that which is healthy or desirable. So again, the danger is if one is not only is on currently an SSRI antidepressant, but even if one has taken one it recently, because these compounds stick around for a long time in your system. For instance, Prozac, one has to be off of Prozac for at least 4 to 5 weeks before we believe it's safe to take ayahuasca.
So you do believe, though, that people should, if they're going to take it, it needs to be in that kind of a setting where it's controlled. You can't just go out to Brazil or wherever and get it.
No, I think one has to be very, very careful and cautious about the context within which one ingests this.
What if a shaman was there? You know, what if somebody did? He went to South America, and a shaman administered this. What do you think?
There's something called set and setting, and it's creating a context and a container. And typically when people go and work with a shaman and they use plant medicines, it would be under a very sort of thoughtful environment where they're used to it, and they understand, and they set you up for it, and they create a container where it's safe for it. And the interesting thing about ayahuasca, when you talk about, you know, all the yucky parts of it, all the ways in which it sounds just really hideous, when people describe the experience, the fact that they throw up or that they have these really, you know, nauseous kinds of feelings is part of the transformative experience of it. And people describe it with great wonder afterward.
I don't think I have ever described doing that with great wonder.
It's amazing. And, you know, the interesting thing about it is what it looks like from the outside as compared to what it feels like from the inside. And that's one of those things. It's one of those tension areas of, I think, breakthrough potential in science and in society, is really looking at the interface between the nature of our inner experience and our intuitions and our impulses and our intentions, you know, and then, you know, this larger physical world in which we're embedded.
What's the difference here, then, between, and we'll get you both involved in this question, the brain and the mind? Because I've always been a believer that the mind can exist without the physical brain. Because if you believe in the afterlife, if you believe in telepathy, if you believe in all these things that we talk about in this program, you don't necessarily need the brain to function with all this. Where do you two sit? I mean, if the brain dies, does everything else go with it?
Charlie?
Well, that's a great question. I think it remains one. This whole brain-mind interface remains one of the great mysteries and one of the more fascinating areas of consciousness research. But getting back to the topic of hallucinogens, what's so extraordinary is how they induce profound effects even at a minute dose. And the implication is, and our knowledge is such, that it's apparent that our brains are wired to receive this experience. We're wired to be receptive. So, a minute dose, often on a microgram level, can induce profound alterations of our experience of consciousness, perhaps indicating that these alternative levels of consciousness, their potentialities remain innate and ever-present in all of our minds and only are accessed under extreme circumstances.
Well, see, this is what baffles me, though, Charles. If the mind exists beyond the brain, mm-hmm. why do we need psychedelics to enhance it or to function with it?
Well, I think the psychedelics, and again, as Marilyn said earlier, the psychedelics are not the only vehicle that one can use to experience these altered states, but they do give us a sense, a perception that such states exist, that there is something beyond our day-to-day rational cognitive how we negotiate the whatever comes our way each day, that there is something well beyond, perhaps something more along the level of a dream experience that we're talking about.
Have other researchers got involved in this from days gone past, or is it all current people? Have we had like the Sigmund Freuds of our day? Has anybody else tried to do research into this arena?
Well, which arena? In terms of the brain-mind question? That's
yes.
Like one of the hottest areas in science right now.
Oh, yeah. My aunt, who is no longer with us, was one of the first researchers back in the 60s. I don't know if you knew her, Dr. Shafika Koregula.
Uh-huh.
She wrote the book Breakthrough to Creativity.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she was hooked on that.
Mm-hmm.
She would have loved this study.
She would have loved the breakthroughs that have happened in the last.
She would have been at your conference.
Oh,
of course, then again, she may be. Who knows?
Well, exactly. We stay open to multiple levels. We are very integral in our model. And so my answer to this brain-mind question, there's different levels of evidence. And so one level of answering the question is like my own personal sort of subjective opinion on this, and the other is like, what does the science tell us? And I think that it's kind of like, for me, a radio, in the sense that there's the hard wiring, which is the brain, and then there's the waves that are out there connecting us in all kinds of ways, like right now. And so it's both. It is both the notion that there's this physicality to our brain, and I think if you take a sledgehammer and pound somebody on the head, you will see consciousness goes away, unfortunately and sadly.
Let's throw out a disclaimer to Marilyn and Charles for people not to go out in the woods looking for mushrooms
exactly.
to ingest.
Right.
That's how you die.
Yes, that's true.
All right, well, both of you stay with us. We're going to be back with you in just a moment. Their websites, of course, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. You can email me also at george@coasttocoastam.com. And next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. I know a lot of you have been calling now. Why don't you wait just a little bit? We'll give you an opportunity to chat with both of them next hour. We'll be back in just a second, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I'm in my second earthquake. Not a very big one, but a 3.2 nonetheless that just happened not too far from where we are. As a matter of fact, 4 miles from the very infamous Northridge earthquake. We were just talking with Stephen Quayle about earthquakes. So let's hope things aren't brewing up. But just happened, and just felt it. I felt a thud, and thought it might have been the pizza delivery man trying to break his way into the door. It was not. But 4 miles from where we are right now, that's pretty darn close. Back in a moment with our two special guests. And next hour, we'll open up the phone lines on Coast to Coast AM. Charles in Maryland, somebody just sent me a message and said, why don't you try the ayahuasca live on the air and see what happens? I think I'll pass on that. Let's talk a little bit more about the research that's going on, especially with the mind and the brain. Who was Stanislav Grof? Let's go through him again, Charles.
Sure, sure. Stan Grof was a arguably
still alive and well.
Alive and well, still out there, very active, still writing, still giving lectures. Arguably the productive researcher from the starting in the 1950s with psychedelic drugs. First in his native Czechoslovakia, where he was on the psychiatric faculty of Charles University Medical School in Prague, and then later at Johns Hopkins and the University of Maryland, where he headed the psychedelic research program at the Maryland State Psychiatric Research Center at Spring Grove, Maryland. Did some tremendous work, really groundbreaking work, particularly working with terminal cancer patients, and in many respects we're replicating the early work he did, but also he did some fabulous work with hardcore alcoholics and drug addicts, showing some very promising results with individuals for whom modern medicine still has very limited treatment modalities for.
76, 77 years old, he was a staunch, still is a staunch believer in healing, right, of altered states.
Absolutely.
And its ability to heal.
Oh, very much so, and he's very interested in transpersonal psychology. He was just on the IONS campus yesterday at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California, leading a workshop there. And I think Stan's work, in addition to the kind of application work that Charlie's talking about, he also was attempting through his research and is attempting still to map consciousness, like what are the various levels and dimensions of consciousness, and again, thinking about it in the notion of what are we capable of becoming. I think his work is very much about transformation and personal growth and development, and he's definitely still very active, and he does what is called the holotropic breath work, because it became difficult, obviously, for a variety of reasons, to do the kind of hallucinogen work that he had started with, and so he developed another tool, and this is a kind of breath work, kind of a hyperventilation is not really the right word, but combined with music, and then again the set and setting, creating a context for people to have transpersonal experiences. And so, I mean, he would argue that you can get to these states very definitely without having to use any kind of additional substance, a hallucinogen or anything else. And certainly within the meditation traditions and a variety of like sports, you know, athletes frequently talk about being in the zone. And,
right.
You know, that state of consciousness. I think there are a variety of ways in. And the point really is to both promote healing in the ways that Charlie's talking about, as well as, you know, to promote healing in a broader sense of us coming into the fullness of who we are and, you know, a broader definition of what is real.
Well, are the psychedelics the difference, let's say, between taking a jet to get somewhere or taking a train, that the psychedelics will get you there quicker as opposed to maybe just using your own mind power?
Well, you know, I think there's an argument to be made. These are very, very powerful agents, and taken in the right context, there can be a change can occur with tremendous rapidity. Of course, this was one of the scary aspects of these effects of the drugs back in the 50s and 60s. For instance, in psychiatry, it started to be discussed that perhaps psychedelics could speed up formal psychoanalysis whereby a year's worth of insight derived in formal analysis could be experienced in a single afternoon. This was obviously caused great distress to the conservatives at that time. But again, these are very, very powerful agents. But again, they are only one of a number of different techniques that might induce a similar outcome, although perhaps an approach with the greatest rapidity of result.
The study done by the Hefter Research Institute, is that ongoing now, and what phase is it in?
Well, our study, it's sponsored by the Hefter Institute, and it's being conducted at Harbor UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles. We're approved by the federal regulatory agencies to treat 12 individuals with advanced cancer who have serious anxiety. We recently treated our 11th subject, so we're looking for one final subject,
right,
after which we're going to analyze our data, and if it looks promising, and I believe it will, we plan to apply for permission to extend our work.
All right, you're not trying to cure the cancer.
No, absolutely not. No, we have to be very clear about that. This treatment is not focused on the cancer itself, but rather the secondary psychological reaction to having advanced cancer.
All right. With this work in their anxiety through the psychedelics, what are you doing? Calming them down? What's happening to them?
Well, we get to know them initially. We meet with these individuals. We get a sense of who they are, what their lives have been like, how their lives have been impacted by having cancer. Then we admit them the afternoon before the session, so they can become familiarized with the setting. We use the Clinical Research Center at Harbor UCLA. And then we, in the morning, we conduct our treatment. I am accompanied during the treatment with my research coordinator, Alicia Danforth, and my co-investigator, Preet Chopra. And we sit with them for the entire duration of the experience. Also, our teams really creates a very different kind of setting in the room through hanging fabrics and putting items on the wall. We create a very aesthetically pleasing setting, very much unlike a conventional hospital room. For the session itself, we initially do some more talking. We particularly focus on the intention. Why is the subject embarking upon this experience? What do they hope to get out of it? We then do a little ritual or prayer, if you will. We administer the compound.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a period of time, we urge them to lie down, put on eye shades, and put on headphones, which are hooked up to a CD player. And we have pre-selected music, which we feel is appropriate for the situation. And we urge them to go as deeply as they're able.
Why the prayer, Charles?
Well, the prayer, I think, is to focus, for the individual to really to put out, to articulate why they're here, what they hope, and ask for guidance from whatever agency is
out to help.
Is out there to help, to call on. And I think individuals who have worked a great deal with psychedelics, particularly in plant form, will acknowledge that there may be something to this notion of a spirit realm. And of course, this is entirely antithetical to modern medicine. Yet here we are with these compounds bridging modern medicine with the ancient medicine, which did rely upon spirit forces and spirit energy. So again, we're trying to be all inclusive. And then we urge the person to go as deeply as possible. If they need to talk about what's going on, we're there. We sit with them for the entire 6 hours of the experience. We'll process what they need in regards to processing, and then we encourage them to go deeply again. It's our sense that the best outcome will be associated with the deeper experience. In fact, the work of Groff and Pankey back in the back in the 60s indicate that individuals who had a transpersonal experience or transcendent psycho-spiritual experience are the individuals who are more likely to have the best and most therapeutic outcome. This was also consistent with the ground-setting work of Humphrey Osmond in the late 50s in Canada. He worked with a large series of hardcore chronic alcoholics who were truly hopeless cases. And here he found that those individuals who established sobriety after the one-dose treatment session and were able to maintain it for years afterwards were those individuals who had a powerful mystical or mystico-mimetic experience, if you were, during the course of their psychedelic experience.
Do most of them say that they had a very powerful mystical experience?
Well, looking in the literature, reading their discussions and speaking with the old investigators, certainly that is acknowledged. In regards to the study we're doing, we are approved at a moderate dose level. So we're not quite getting to that mystical plane, but we are, people are experiencing very powerful, having very powerful psychodynamic experiences, which are very emotionally evocative and not at all distressing in the negative sense, but rather cathartic and cleansing. And afterwards, our subjects have talked about how valuable they felt the experience to be. Now, we don't have definitive results because we haven't finished studying all of our subjects and we haven't crunched the hard quantifiable quantitative data. Nevertheless, it's our subjective impression working with these people and staying in close touch after the treatment that they believe it's been of considerable value.
Oh man, you know, it's great research. It will continue. Like you said, you're trying to get a few more people enrolled. Are you seeing a difference with them already, even though the study is not over yet?
Well, certainly. With again, I'll also mention that people only have one psilocybin experience. They come in on two separate occasions. On one occasion, they get a placebo, and the other occasion.
All right, so it's not ongoing.
No. This is one experience only. But we try to stay in touch. We stay in touch by the conditions of the study for 6 months collecting data. But if the individual survives longer than 6 months, we certainly make considerable efforts to stay closely in touch, and the feedback we get has been quite positive. So we're certainly encouraged to continue this work and to pursue getting additional approval for additional studies.
Marilyn, back to what you do in your work then, what kind of reaction do you get from mainstream scientists about something like this?
Well, I haven't done any work specifically on the plant medicines other than my anthropological field work, but certainly we're interested, going back to your question about the brain and the mind and what are the implications of the kind of experiences that people are describing when they have these, you know, hallucinogenic experiences or transpersonal experiences that, you know, Stan Grof and others have described. There is this idea that maybe our experience and our consciousness and our self in some way is more than just the physical dimensions of our being. And, you know, we've been doing research for now almost 30 years looking at the possibility that one person could influence another person's physiology at a distance. So we do these distant intentionality experiments, and, you know, we would invite you into our lab, and we'd love to do that anytime you're ready. And we would monitor your physiology.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, we'd have a healer or a psychic or in another room attempting to influence you, or perhaps a better way to frame it is to connect with you in ways that allow a kind of synchronous experience between their intention and your physiology. And we've now done, there've been 35 randomized double-blind protocol type studies that have been reported, and they show a significant correlation between one person's intention and another person's physiology. And that suggest some kind of interconnectedness or some kind of, you know, way in which we are more than just the physical dimensions of our experience. If my intention can somehow reach out and connect to you in a physical way, even though we're separated, you know, by distance, mm-hmm. That suggests that perhaps consciousness isn't just our brain and just isn't just our body. And at the same time, you know, what has been revolutionary in the last 10 years is advances in the cognitive neurosciences and the fact that the science of the brain is, you know, just amazing what we're discovering about the neuroplasticity of the brain, the fact that it stays fluid and flexible. They're actually identifying places in the brain where you can, you know, find the ability to attribute an intention to another person in your brain. So in other words, when you think about, is that person going to be nice to me or not, there's actually a place in your brain that lights up when you have that feeling about that other person. You know, and this is true in many different domains. They're looking at love, they're looking at altruism, they're looking at forgiveness, you know. There's so much amazing work that's going on about the physical dimensions of consciousness, but I don't think we should forget that there are also this, you know, body of data that says perhaps consciousness is more than just its physical dimensions.
Well, I there's no question that you're onto something with this, and there's that cross mix between real science, real medicine, metaphysics. But who's to say, Marilyn, that this, what you do, is not real science too?
Oh, well, I think it is. And I think what's interesting about the moment we're living in is that we have the opportunity to bring the sophistication and the rigor and the, you know, the utility of science together with these insights from, you know, the wisdom traditions, the indigenous cultures that we were just talking about, and to bring all that together. And I think what we have the potential to do right now is to answer really old questions in an entirely new way. And, I mean, that's part of the reason we're having this big conference, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. As I mentioned, we're having a conference, Palm Springs, August 9th through 12th. And also, I think it's, you know, a way, there are experiments that each of us can do that bring together our inner experience with then the outer world. And the Institute of Noetic Sciences actually has a number of online experiments. If people go to noetic.org, you can actually test your own ESP. And we have the Halls of Healing where people can go in and actually look at intuitive diagnosis.
And you get some pretty instant results there?
You can, yes. You see where you're going and you see results. And there are a variety of different ways of tracking the data. Dean Radin has done a lot of work in this area.
He's one of the best.
Yeah, one of the best, for sure, and I get to work with him every day at the Institute of Noetic Science.
Well, you know, they did the fire in the grid just a few weeks ago, and those Princeton, the Global Consciousness Project there, it spiked. They got some readings. They don't want to go out on a limb yet and say, hey, it works, but they got some readings. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.